You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at the story behind a Wisconsin law that mandates teaching about Native American history, cultures, and tribal sovereignty in state schools. Now, Starbucks made headlines recently when it announced that it would eliminate plastic straws by 2020. There are also some municipalities like Seattle that have already made a move to ban single-use plastic straws, and others, including Chicago, are considering joining them. Many hail this as a good move to reduce plastic waste that impacts the environment and oceans in particular. But members of the disability rights community have raised concerns that there are people who need those straws and that alternatives pose risks. They also say that this is just the latest in a long line of policy decisions that are made without consulting people with disabilities, even though they will be impacted. Karen Hitzelberger has a postgrad diploma in disability studies from the University of Leeds in England. She has cerebral palsy and wrote a recent piece for the Washington Post titled, "Plastic Straw Bans Are the Latest Policy to Forget the Disability Community." Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, great to be here.
Let's talk about this straw ban, first of all. What types of disabilities might make drinking straws really important for some people to have access to?
Well, for example, I have cerebral palsy, and I have muscle spasms, so I have trouble holding a cup. So I drink out of a straw a lot. Also, because I just have trouble drinking out of a cup, I'll end up either choking on the liquid or spilling it all over myself, or instead of drinking it, I usually wear it or choke on it. So cerebral palsy, muscular dystrophy, multiple sclerosis, like there's tons of different disabilities that make straws really important. And I certainly can't name them all, but those are just a few examples.
So this would be, for a lot of people, an issue of access, I guess, equal access to a service here, but also a safety issue, it sounds like, for some.
Yeah, and, like, there's the issue of why don't you bring your own straw, and a lot of people do. But what happens the one time you forget your straw? You know, if you all of a sudden have no access to straws, it does become an access and a safety issue.
And as you wrote in your piece for the Washington Post, this is more than just an issue about straws. This is a case where an idea that maybe sounded good to people in the abstract, when people didn't consult with people with disabilities, they overlooked part of the story. And that's in the big picture, it sounds like what has you worried.
Yeah, it does. And I think it has me worried because you start with straws and then what's next? And when people with disabilities are not part of the story, we get left out and the things we need slowly start disappearing. Bendy straws were invented for use in hospitals and for people with disabilities, and now they're everywhere, but we kind of forget the roots of it and forget that there are still people for whom they're more than a modern convenience, they're a necessity.
So if people with disabilities had been consulted, do you think there might have been a compromise where maybe there isn't that straw dispenser where everybody grabs a straw without thinking, but there is still that access to a flexible straw for people who need it?
Yeah, certainly. Whether it's that, like, I know there's a lot of debate over should it be that I have to ask for a straw, or should it be that before they put a straw in my drink, they say, hey, do you need a straw? And I mean, either one of those to me seem like reasonable options, but just the option of it still being there and still being accessible and not disappearing altogether.
You also touched on a couple issues where you see a similar thing happening where, for example, college professors or instructors or universities as a whole would want to ban kinds of technology, laptop computers or other devices from classrooms. And that's something that definitely got a lot of attention from students with disabilities. Can you talk about why that was maybe a case where people with disabilities should have been consulted up front?
Sure. I'll again use myself as an example because I know myself better than I know anyone else. I can't write. I mean, I can't handwrite things. So I would need a laptop to be able to take notes in a class. I would probably record the lecture and transcribe it later because I use voice dictation software, but I would need my laptop and to just outright ban laptops, neglect that there are people who don't have another option, who can't. Like, people say, well, handwriting is better, you remember things better, and that may be true if you can actually handwrite. But if you can't, you still need the option of using a laptop. And I think that's why a lot of students with disabilities kind of were put off, shall we say, by laptop bans and things like that, because it, again, neglected that for students with disabilities and for people with disabilities, a lot of what is your modern convenience for able-bodied people has become necessities for us.
When you raise issues like this, whether we're talking about banning straws or banning laptops or other devices from a classroom, when you raise the issue, what kind of response do you get? Is it, I hadn't thought of that?
You get some of that, and then you get other people maybe not being as understanding and saying that it's not really an issue and you're making an issue out of nothing. But you get a lot of people who say, you know, oh, I hadn't thought of that. So you get both sides.
So for people, whether it's a business, a university, whatever, who are planning on making some kind of change, and they're maybe not thinking of it as an accessibility issue that's not even on the radar for them, how would you like them to start before they come up with the plan?
I think if you're thinking of banning anything, you have to consult people from every community and look at, hey, how does your community use this item? And that includes the disability community.
We'll leave it there. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Karen Hitzelberger has a postgrad diploma in disability studies from the University of Leeds in England. She has cerebral palsy and wrote a piece for The Washington Post titled "Plastic Straw Bans Are the Latest Policy to Forget the Disability Community." First, at a few different points in their school years, Wisconsin students are taught about the state's federally recognized Native American tribes, their histories, and their cultures. But that wasn't always the case, and there was no policy or law to make sure it would happen until Act 31 was passed in 1989. J.P. Leary is a member of the Cherokee and Delaware Nations. He's an associate professor of humanities, First Nation studies, and history at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He served as the American Indian Studies Consultant at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction from 1996 until 2011. His new book is titled The Story of Act 31, How Native History Came to Wisconsin Classrooms. He joins us from our WPR studios in Green Bay. JP, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, Rob. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I want to set the scene in the early to mid-80s here in Wisconsin when a group of Ojibwe moved to reassert their treaty rights in the state. Give us the background on that story and what followed.
Sure. Very quickly, two brothers from Le Coup d'Oreille, Fred and Mike Tribble, in 1974 created a test case reasserting treaty rights that were first reserved in treaties signed in 1837 and 1842 with the federal government of the United States. And that litigation wound its way through the court system, and in 1983 the federal courts found that, yes, indeed, those treaty rights did still exist and they were still valid. And so from 1983 to about 1991, there was ongoing litigation to determine what the scope of those rights was to be, who could regulate for things like safety and environmental protection, and whether any damages were due for the roughly century or so that those rights had been infringed.
And you mentioned reasserting rights. As I understand it, as you write about these treaties, when they were signed back in the 1830s, they're along the lines of the Native American representatives saying, yes, you can use this land, but we maintain certain, I think the legal term is usufruct rights, right to use it for, use the natural resources in ways that we've been doing all along. Do I have that right?
You have it exactly right, Rob, that when you own a piece of land, you also own things like mineral rights and usage rights and all of this. And so with these large-scale real estate transactions, essentially, what you have is the Ojibwe peoples reserving the right to use that land. So that remained essentially unseated or unsold.
Now, take us into the backlash. People look back and I think talk about the spearfishing controversy, but take us back to how these rights started to be exercised and the reaction they were met with.
Sure. So the book is called The Story of Act 31, and the sort of oversimplified, I think, story says that we had the Voight decision in 1983, which re-recognized these treaty rights, and then we end up with some legislative and actions that create new statutory requirements for teaching about history, culture, and tribal sovereignty. What I'm saying, though, is if you look at that post-Voight decision backlash, which escalated into violent controversies, and there was the real fear that someone would be killed at a Wisconsin boat landing by protesters up throughout the 1980s. And so what I decided to ask is, where did those protests come from? And so that lens sort of reframes this from another example of social policy, where we're taking a social issue and looking to the schools to solve it, to really asking questions like, well, where did the backlash come from? And why was there so little public understanding of key issues like tribal history, tribal cultures, tribal sovereignty, and treaty rights, of course? And so what I got to looking at was, what opportunities did past generations of Wisconsin students have to learn about these issues? So rather than vilify any individual person, rather than look at things like racism, stereotyping, and discrimination as individual failings, I took a broader, more systemic kind of approach to really look at that, and then to think about how did tribal leaders, Native educators, and allies transform curriculum policy in the state of Wisconsin to address those issues.
And that is the heart of your book. Let's talk about what was out there and what wasn't out there in education before Act 31, which we'll get into in a minute. What were people in Wisconsin learning and not learning about Native Americans past and present?
Right. So one of the issues is that when you look at how Native people are depicted in curriculum materials, There's sort of an ongoing issue with sort of two dynamics. One is invisibility, so it's absence, and the other is problematic presence, meaning that Native people are often included in biased and stereotypical ways when they are included. And so one of the things that I was looking at the way that social studies, and let me be clear, social studies, because that's what the law requires, is that this instruction is in social studies. So it's not only social studies. The best way to think about it is at least social studies. And so I looked at the history of social studies education and looked at the ways that social studies curriculum policy was responding to social crises. So, for example, what was going on in social studies in response to World War II? What was going on in social studies in response to the Civil Rights Movement? What was going on in social studies with these other big sort of social issues? And there really wasn't, there was a parallel insofar as the field was very slow to respond to these sorts of things. So what I then did was moved into looking at how does this play out in Wisconsin. And so I looked at one of the leading textbooks that first came out in the 1950s called Exploring Wisconsin. And I looked at multiple editions and I got to see through that how the story was told and how it was shaped by the events of the era. But those textbooks, they only really tell what we think we taught, right? It validates certain kinds of knowledge. And by the way, for most of those editions, there was much more included about Paul Bunyan, so a fictional white man, than anything about Native people. That's just an interesting aside. So then I looked at a journal called Badger History, put out by my publisher, the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Badger History came out by the Historical Society from 1948 to about 1980. And one of the interesting things about Badger History is it shows not just what we think we taught, but it includes actual student work product. So we know what students actually learned. And part of the reason that's interesting is we see that feedback loop. So we see the student produce some piece of work in response to ostensibly a teacher-created assignment. That teacher then evaluates that favorably, then sends that down to Madison, where it's again reviewed by the editors of Badger History, and then it's then put out statewide as exemplary student work about Wisconsin history. Some of that is includes some significant misunderstandings. So they talk about being among the wonderful Menominee dancers of the Lac des Flambeaux Reservation. And of course, Lac des Flambeaux is an Ojibwe reservation. So looking at how that level of misunderstanding went all the way up the line. And then we also see an issue came out in 1948 in which the same issue, the very next article, talks about the Declaration of Human Rights, and it talks about genocide. Well, there's a short story told from the perspective of the Fox River about the, the history is wrong too, but celebrating the genocide of the Fox Nation and how the river was running red with blood and the gay and gallant Frenchmen would have unfettered access to river passage.
I want to get to Act 31 itself, JP. So with that background you just laid out, in the midst of this the treaty controversies of the 80s, what were people trying to accomplish? How are they trying to change what was taught in schools?
Right. The way that I think about it, and I want to be clear that I worked at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction from 1996 to 2011 as the American Indian Studies consultant. So in that capacity, I had the opportunity to work with and learn from a lot of the people that were absolutely instrumental in creating this, what was at that time the most specific curriculum requirement in terms of content to be taught enacted in the state of Wisconsin. And as you know, we've long prided ourselves on a history of local control. And so as we say, then schools must teach about history, culture, and tribal sovereignty. That was unprecedented. But I'm talking about people like Alan Caldwell. And the late Alan Caldwell worked, he was the first American Indian Studies consultant at the Department of Public Instruction. He also served in, there was a number of key organizations that worked together. Department of Public Instruction, Wisconsin Indian Education Association, Great Lakes Intertribal Council, American Indian Language and Culture Education Board, and then the state legislature's American Indian Study Committee, which included a number of public members. And so we see people like Alan Caldwell, member of the Menominee Nation, at DPI, also on WIEA board, also a technical advisor to the American Indian Study Committee. We see, at that time, UW-Green Bay's own Bill Galnick, a member of the Oneida Nation, worked with the American Indian Language and Culture Education Board, later joined the American Indian Studies program at the Department of Public Instruction. Dorothy W. Davids, the late Dorothy Davids, member of the Mohican Nation. And one of the things that I tell in the very early in the book is the story of Dorothy's dad. And Dorothy's dad spoke at the American Indian Chicago Conference, calling for the kind of policies that would later echo in what was enacted in Act 31. And then also looking at some of the key legislative figures, Representative Sharon Metz, former Rep. Sharon Metz, is kind of one of the unsung heroes of this. Many people know her work through Honor Our Neighbors, Origins and Rights, and doing that treaty rights support kind of work. But she was absolutely instrumental as a Wisconsin legislator. Representative Frank Boyle. And none of this would have happened without support from Governor Tommy Thompson. So there were some interesting political alliances that led to this to happen. And it was some coordinated efforts across Indian country, across Indian Ed, and within state government as well.
Can you run through what changed in Wisconsin curriculum? For a student in a classroom, what would they encounter that was different, thanks to those efforts you just laid out?
Mm-hmm. So what we see, The law required students to receive instruction at least twice in K-8 and at least once in high school. It required that their teachers have received instruction in history, culture, and tribal sovereignty, either as part of their pre-service ed or part of their ongoing professional development associated with licensure. It required use of much more multicultural curriculum materials. It was part of a broader human relations instruction. So it really took a high context, multifaceted approach to reshaping and recrafting opportunities to learn for students in Wisconsin.
And are we living up to what was laid out there now in 2018?
There are some real bright spots around the state, and much of this you can see on a website called WisconsinFirstNations.org. So you can see some of the exemplars. You can see interviews with some of the outstanding teachers around the state and some of the video clips that can be used in the classroom.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. JP, thanks a lot for sharing this with us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, Rob.
JP Leary is an associate professor of humanities, First Nation studies, and history at UW Green Bay. He joined us from our WPR studios in Green Bay to talk about his new book. It's called The Story of Act 31, How Native History Came to Wisconsin Classrooms. Not counting their six-game losing streak heading into this week's Major League Baseball All-Star Game, the first half of the season was pretty good for the Milwaukee Brewers. They're 55-43, just 2.5 games behind the Chicago Cubs for first place in the National League Central, and they sent a franchise record 5 players to the All-Star Game. But they've also been shut out 10 times, have grounded into more double plays than nearly every team in the National League, and they're near the bottom in getting on base, not what you'd expect from a team that had the best record in the league for much of the season. Baseball is weird like that lately, and our guest says that's not a good thing. He says the list of problems facing Major League Baseball is long and that the league needs to find some solutions. Bob Nightingale is the Major League Baseball columnist for USA Today. Bob, welcome to Central Time.
Sure, my pleasure.
Well, you wrote recently that baseball is just, well, not all that exciting, or not as exciting as it used to be. What kind of things are happening on the field that's making it a little less interesting lately?
Well, this would be the most strikeouts every four in baseball history, with fewer balls ever put in play in baseball history. So what we saw in the All-Star game with the 10 home runs and 25 strikeouts is a microcosm of what we've seen during the season. And baseball is very concerned about that. You know, when you're going several minutes between when a ball is even put in play, there's a problem. And attendance is down about 6.5% throughout baseball. And the Bears are losing the younger fans to football and basketball.
So what is it that's happening? Are there changes in the game, how it's played, how it's coached, the rules that have made it so that we have more incidents where the ball isn't in play, the strikeouts, the home runs, the walks?
Yeah, the pitchers are better than before. They're throwing harder than ever before. And now they've kind of, teams have kind of gone to more shifts, trying to prevent the singles and doubles and, you know, kind of putting more defenders in where the ball's put in play more often. So that's created players thinking, let me beat the shift by trying to hit home runs. So that's where we're seeing a plethora of home runs plus strikeouts.
Let's talk about that shift, because this was kind of a new thing for me. I used to be a more hardcore baseball fan, more of a casual observer now, which is maybe part of the problem for the major leagues. What happens in the shift? Who's shifting and how?
It's for the left-handed hitters, primarily. And so if a left-handed hitter normally pulls a ball, so he hits the ball on the right side of the infield, what teams do now is they'll move that third baseman, sometimes all the way over the second base bag, and the shortstop joins the second baseman, and the first baseman moves over. So they have a number of infielders on the right-hand side kind of daring the hitter to the hit to the shortstop or third base where it's vacated, and they don't do that. So a lot of times balls they think is good, that's normally a hit are now and out.
Want to go to our Facebook commenters now. Tim writes, baseball hasn't changed much in 100 years. If you like it, you like it. If you don't, you don't. Let's not try reinventing America's pastime. So is there something to be said, hey, if you're a real fan of the game, you love the cat and mouse game between the batter that leads to a pitcher and batter that leads to a strikeout. A home run is a big dramatic moment in the game. Is this really so bad, Bob?
Well, it is bad because people aren't watching the game like they used to, whether in the ballparks themselves, the national TV audiences are down. So it's a problem. I mean, you talk to a baseball Hall of Famers, some of them are embarrassed that the game is being played this way, where it's almost like a slow-pitch softball game. It's either home run, strikeout, or walk. We just don't see the action like we used to.
Talking to Bob Nightingale, Major League Baseball columnist with USA Today. He's worried about the quality of the game. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a baseball fan? Were you? Do you think it's getting more boring? What should we do about it, if anything? 800-642-1234. And Bob, you say there's a growing obsession with statistics from the teams in the media, and that's taken some of the fun out of the game, you think?
Oh, it is. It used to be, who's got the highest batting average in baseball? Who's got the most home runs? Who's got the most RBI? Now people are worried about, different statistics. Ball in play stat, ERA plus, the difference in, whether a left-handed pitcher, right-handed pitcher is pitching. It seems like we're talking about so many different statistics rather than actual runs scored or runs produced. And it's almost like the scoreboard, which reflects, who wins or loses a game. Like, that's the least important stat, is the run scored.
It's been a while now, but there was that book and then movie Moneyball about, coaches using these statistics to get these unsung hero players and make just the right decision with these statistics to win games. I mean, do you think that's part of what led to this, to where we are now, the strikeouts, the shifts, the boring play?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, even the architect of that, Billy Beane, general manager of the A's, has even joked, like, sorry, guys, I never thought I was going to get to this. It's almost like this is what the analytics people wanted, and this is what they got, where you don't see the balls put in play. You don't see stolen bases or hit and runs, the sort of thing everybody grew up on.
Are the people who set rules in baseball worried about this and thinking, okay, we got to make some tweaks by next season to add some more zing to the game?
Yes, Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred, very concerned. So is the union chief, Tony Clark. It's just not the same type of game. They plan to meet very soon and go over different ideas. What can be done to bring more action to the game?
What are some of the ideas that people are throwing out there?
Maybe to either ban those shifts or at least limit the shifts. Talk about even lowering the pitching mound like it did in 1968 when Bob Gibson had the 1.12 ERA, moving the pitching mound back. All kinds of different ideas, even changing extra inning rules where a runner starts on second base with nobody out in extra innings just to force the extra inning games to go quicker.
We're talking about the problems facing baseball with Bob Nightingale, MLB columnist for the USA Today. He says there are too many strikeouts, too much disparity between good teams and bad, games too long, not enough action. The list goes on, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Lines filling up already. Is Major League Baseball bad, more boring than it used to be, or do you love the game the way it is today? And if you think there are changes needed, what change? 800-642-1234 is the number. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation. Take some of your calls coming up on Central Time.
The windup and the 2-2 pitch. Oh, no, sir, wait a minute. The batter is calling for time. Looks like he's going and getting himself a new bat. And now there's a beach ball on the field. And the ball boys are discussing which one of them's going to go get it.
I never realized how boring this game is.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about some of the problems our guest says are facing Major League Baseball. Homer Simpson there getting bored with the game, and our guest says the way things are going, Homer isn't alone. Bob Nightingale is Major League Baseball columnist for USA Today, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think baseball needs to change, or do you like it the way it is? Do you want to see more action on the field, or are you okay with the growing number of strikeouts, home runs, and walks, not balls actually in play on the field? Let's go to your calls now. Chris is with us in Iron River. Chris, hi.
Good morning.
What do you think, Chris?
Well, you know, a couple things. I'm one of the maybe few people, but I think there's more of us out there that I like a good pitching game. I'd rather see a game with three hits than a game with 15 hits. I do like to see a good pitcher's duel. And the other thing, if you think about baseball in the past, a lot of the good hitters were spray hitters, and they hit the ball all over the field, and there's no reason that can't happen again. I think hitters just are trying for the fence too much. It has nothing to do with their inability to, you know, to make that adjustment.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. And, Bob, that makes me think about my changing appreciation for things like basketball, American football, and soccer, where I used to like the high-scoring game, and now more and more I appreciate the defensive battle. Is there something to what Chris is saying, Bob?
Well, Urban likes, you know, good pitching performances, but it's not the same. I mean, Max Scherzer of the Washington Nationals just passed Bob Gibson for the most career games of 10 or more strikeouts. And Scherzer was very embarrassed by it, saying, well, the game's not the same. People used to care if they struck out. Nobody cares anymore. They think strikeouts are the same thing as an out. You know, nobody tries to hit the ball the other field or just puts a ball in play. So the strikeout totals are the most alarming. And, you know, we have strikeouts or walks. It means there's a lot of time during a three-hour game when nothing happens.
Chris, thanks for the call. We'll go to Miller in Green Bay. Miller, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you think?
Well, you know, just going off of what Chris said, you know, just all that time where, you know, in between pitches and whatnot, you know, it's kind of a social aspect, too, on the game. You know, I take my my girlfriend and a couple of my buddies out to the Brewer game once in a while, you know, but sometimes, you know, you get a bunch of hits, sometimes not. The last one I went to a Cardinal game in June. It was really slow. You know, just how it is, I guess.
All right, Miller, thanks a lot for the call. They named the stadium after you anyway, so that's good. Bob, what do you think? The social element of being in the stands is still pretty fun, Miller says.
It's still fun, and that's what a baseball teams are trying to do. They're getting new ballparks now, even ballparks that are old, trying to get people just to come and kind of party and hang out, that the game's not keeping their interest anymore. So teams, you know, even historic teams like the Yankees, are making more of a conscious effort of putting in different bars and rooftop bars and places for younger people to hang out because people are not paying attention to the game.
We heard from Scott on Facebook. Scott says, put a pitch clock on the pitcher. And I've seen that idea thrown around. Bob, what would that mean?
We will see that. I think Rob Manfred wants to install that next year just to kind of pick up the pace of the play, where you have 20 seconds to throw the pitch so that pitchers aren't taking too long out there and slowing the game down, thinking that might create some more excitement.
Let's go back to our callers. Tracy is with us in Minocqua. Tracy, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I've noticed that due to the rapid trades, I no longer recognize my team anymore, so I don't have any individual person or player to root for anymore.
Interesting, Tracy. A trades, free agency, she doesn't feel that connection to the players on her team, Bob.
No, that's a very valid point. I mean, what we're seeing now is that with free agency and the great movement, is hardly anybody stays their own team. You know, the days of, you know, Robin Yount staying with the Brewers or George Brett with the Royals, Tony Gwynn with the Padres, you know, those days it seems like they're over.
Tracy, thanks for calling in. Stan is with us now in Franklin. Stan, hi.
Yeah, hi. Real quick, you know, we talked about the strikeouts. There's no discipline. There's no discipline for these hitters. I mean, you've got a lot of hitters that you got a couple of real great good hitters that are in, you know, in the high 200s to 300s, which is kind of rare. But then you get a lot of these guys that there's just no discipline at the plate. They just swing at everything out of the box, you know, in the ground, whatever. And you know, and these guys, on top of it, you add in the fact that You know, they're paid, you know, a pretty good salary for a real low average hitters. I mean, it's unbelievable. And also the aesthetics of the game, away from the performances, you know, you've got this excessive spitting, which when you're watching a game on TV, it's just gross when you see that. The jewelry that these guys wear is just unbelievable. How they get by with that, playing in that kind of, with that kind of attire. And some of the hair on these guys, they look like they're rock stars for music.
Stan, thanks a lot for the call, a lot there. I think the spitting has always been there, Bob. But let's get to the hitting a little more. And an earlier caller said something about there's no shame in striking out anymore. And, yeah, it used to be if you struck out, that's a failure. If you ground out, well, hey, at least you put the ball in play.
Right. Now people are treating the strike out the same as a ground out. Well, an ounce and out. And it isn't. And there isn't as much discipline. It used to be embarrassed to be striking out 100 times a year. Now guys are striking out, you know, 100 times by the All-Star break. They had these shifts, but, you know, people are saying, well, you can beat the shift, you know, hit, learn to hit, you know, to the other side of the field. And we're not seeing that.
Thanks for the call. Scott is with us next in Sharon. Scott, hello.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think that the shift, it's a great defensive tactic. It's come into the game. Hitters just need to be able to hit the ball to the other where the player's not. Not that hard, you know?
And do you see any, are you worried that the game is getting worse, or are you still okay with what it is, Scott?
I think what's making the game worse is the price of the tickets at the end of the stadium and getting anxious.
Kind of breaking up there, Scott was saying that ticket prices, the cost of going to a game is maybe part of what keeps him away. Is that something people are seeing around the country, Bob?
Yeah, but ticket prices are, you know, much lower than the other sports, much lower than football, basketball, hockey. So that's not really a concern. I mean, ticket prices still are very low, particularly just, you know, general admission ticket, you know, not to be behind home plate. So, yeah, I'm not sure how valid of excuse that is because they certainly haven't gone up much in price, particularly for regular season games. It's just that, you know, you got to get people to, you know, come to the gates, and if they're bored by the game, they're not coming.
We heard on Facebook from Paul who says, read a book between innings or pitches. It's about the same amount of time. That probably isn't the way Major League Baseball is hoping their fans are participating with the game on just in the background.
No, if you see some fans reading books during the game, that's about as bad a sight as you can get. No, they do not want that. They want people standing and cheering and everything else, not sitting back and not paying attention. So, yeah, that's, baseball's trying to overcome this, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, do you think that we're going to see noticeable changes by the 2019 season, Bob, briefly as we wrap up?
I do. I think we'll see a pitch clock. I don't know if we'll see a band of shifts. I think we'll do different things. They've already kind of curtailed how many times a catcher can go to a mound or other infielders can go to the mound. So maybe a little different things like that. But I think we'll be in just – small increments over the next few years, just trying to get this solved.
Bob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks, Rob.
That's Bob Nightingale, Major League Baseball columnist for the USA Today. We talked to him about the problems he says are plaguing Major League Baseball. Still time for you to share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's been 1 month since floods caused around $11 million in damage to roads and public infrastructure in northern Wisconsin. This week, officials with the Federal Emergency Management Agency were getting a closer look at washed-out roads and whether the region will qualify for a federal disaster declaration. As Danielle Kading reports, that declaration is tied to money that could help the region recover.
A caravan of cars is driving down a stretch of road in Bayfield County. Getting out of his car, Troy Christensen with FEMA says it was good a road engineer told him to go slow.
I'm glad he mentioned not to go too fast. Because from a distance, it just looks like a big area of shade.
What looks like a shadow is actually a huge gaping hole where the road is missing.
So this is what we call a significant total road washout.
That's Catherine Warren, a public assistance specialist with FEMA. She's part of a team doing damage assessments in the county. Warren says they visit sites like this to gauge how much repairs might cost.
So at this site, they'll have to put the culvert back in and put a lot of big rocks on top of it to hold it in place, hopefully, during the next storm.
After a walk around, the team heads out to drive to a similar site, not far from this one. The roads turn from gravel to blacktop, back to gravel again. It's a temporary fix that towns have been using until they can repair washed-out roads. When the team arrives, Mason road worker Mark Lake points out a 60-foot drain pipe mangled in pieces among the trees. He says it's been long, hot days since the flooding.
We've worked on other roads, getting them open. But there are still some people that have to drive, you know, 4 or 5 miles out of the way to get to an open road.
Lake says the town has 56 areas where roads are damaged or washed out. So far, they've been able to make 10 passable and hope to finish this one by the end of the week. He says the rest will take time and money.
You look at the money that's involved to fix this stuff, and you're looking at 3, maybe 4 times the amount of money that the township has for the entire budget. Not just the roads budget, everything.
That's why county and town officials in northern Wisconsin are hoping for a federal disaster declaration. It would mean access to more money to fix roads and public infrastructure. But that won't help close to 80 homes and businesses damaged by flooding. There would have to be about 6 times that many damaged for individuals to qualify for federal aid. Chester Brower of Delta has been relying on his neighbors to help him clear out mounds of sand that flooded his home.
Where the house was, there was just nothing but water. The whole, as far as you could see, there was water. Because there was like a river going right through where my home was and down the ditch, down to the town hall, and it washed out the road, just like a whole lane it took out.
He says the wall of water and sand moved his house 3 inches and buried 2 trucks.
Every day is a fresh adventure. I have to spend some time away, otherwise I'd be digging all the time. But that's my goal. I want to be back in my home before the winter.
Friends, neighbors, and strangers have pitched in to help. Cars are lined up and down the road by hides on Busky Bay and Iron River. Inside the restaurant, people are eating spaghetti and buying raffle tickets. Helen Hyde and her husband Don own the restaurant and resort. Stepping outside, Hyde says people and businesses from around the region chipped in to raise money for Brower.
They all came together and donated amazing prizes and gifts and paintings and you name it.
Brower says it definitely lightens the load.
Everybody makes it easier. I always think there's good in people. I'm that glass is half full guy, you know, can't give up.
He says there's nothing to do but keep going. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at the money primary and get the latest on fundraising leading up to next month's primary elections. A new report on candidates' fundraising came out just earlier this week. We'll get the details from a new investigative report on problems with the quality of care at VA nursing homes. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, marshmallows, hobo stew, and beyond, our guest gives us advice and recipes for cooking while camping. That and look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.